tour on Friday, August 30th at 8 p.m. at the Roseland Theater in Portland. The second son of Bob and Rita Marley, eight-time Grammy-winning musician and producer Stephen Marley, will perform in Portland with DJ Sasha Pena, who will be opening the show. Again, that's Stephen Marley, Babylon by Bus Tour, on Friday, August 30th at 8 p.m. at the Roseland Theater, 8 Northwest 6th Avenue in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being a part of our amazing community. Please join us this year at Mic to the People, our annual election meeting. Do you want to help steer KBOO in a positive direction this fall? Plan on attending the annual election meeting, Mic to the People, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater and make your voice heard. Cast your vote by 1 p.m. at the event and enjoy refreshments and live entertainment with local musicians West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. Hear a report back from your board of directors and get to know this year's candidates. Record your fondest memories of KBOO in a minute or less at the Mic to the People booth. This is an all-ages and disability-affirmative event. Again, that's the annual election meeting, Mic to the People, Saturday, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, featuring West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2019. Remember, your voice matters.
You're tuned in to community-supported KBOO Community Radio. Coming up next on Radio Zine is Voices for Animals, which usually airs on KBOO on Fridays. Today's episode is about the mistreatment of wild animals. After today's Radio Zine will be Got Science. And before the show, up next is this. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO members, support listeners, and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven natural foods cooperative open daily from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and a weekly farmers market every Wednesday year-round, located at Southeast Tibbetts Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying our habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Hello and welcome to Voices for the Animals. I'm your host, Michelle Coppola. I share hosting duties with Noah Bristol and Julianne Schwartz, who you heard on last month's episode. I guess I should tell you a little bit about myself. I'm a middle-aged woman who spent the majority of her career in the radio business. I've always kind of worked a side hustle as an animal shelter rescue welfare volunteer for 20-plus years. I've done my share of protesting at facilities where unnecessary animal experimentation was happening. I've also done it at hoarding locations. I fostered more dogs and cats than I can name and even took in a few stray men, but that's for a different show, I guess. I also spent many years volunteering with Fences for Fido. They're a local organization that builds fences for dogs who live outdoors on chains. Wonderful organization. We'll have to talk to them sometime. And now I am here at KBOO, where I guess feisty old radio people come to join the resistance. I'm especially pleased to be one of the new hosts of Voices for the Animals because there's really no other program like it on the air locally that I'm aware of, and I love the opportunity to be a voice for the voiceless, and we are very glad that you have decided to join us and be here as well. Now, we have a really important show for you today, especially if you happen to love horses. Now, even if you don't have a proclivity for our equine friends, you do not want to miss this interview because it's with Brianna Brianna Schwartz. She is the policy counsel for the American Wild Horse Campaign. We're going to be talking to her about what the federal government has been doing to our nation's wild horses with your tax dollars. And if you're an animal lover, you're probably not going to be real happy about it, I can assure you. But we will also give you a way for your voice to be heard so that you don't feel frustrated about what's going on without being able to take some action if you're so inclined. First, however, I want to begin today's show with our Animal Action Calendar. This is a list of local and regional events where you can support animal welfare and animal rights. Coming up on Sunday, September 22nd, there is going to be a vegan beer and taco social put on by Try Vegan PDX that's happening at Lagunitas Community Room in Portland from 4 to 7 p.m. If you've been vegan curious or, you know, just want to dip your toe into the vegan lifestyle, it sounds like a great place to enjoy yourself. And, you know, have some great beer and tacos with friends, all right? Again, that is Sunday, September 22nd, 4 to 7 p.m. at Lagunitas Community Room. Saturday, September 28th, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., the Humane Society of the United States is going to be holding a summit on advancing animal protection through local ordinances. That's happening right around the corner from KBOO here at the Jupiter Hotel on East Burnside. Now, if you're wanting to get involved with animal advocacy, especially on a local level, which is where it really begins, then this is definitely an event you want to go to. You'll be people there who are involved in fighting puppy mills, roadside circuses, cruel wildlife practices, and to work to protect dogs that are living outside. Whatever you're interested in most, you can get inspired and network and meet other like-minded animal advocates. Again, that's Saturday, September 28th, 10 till 3, Jupiter Hotel. And on the weekend of October 5th and 6th, the 15th annual Portland Veg Fest is going to be happening at the Oregon Convention Center. This is always a really fun event. It's another way to get all the info and support you need if you're moving towards or are already living a vegan lifestyle. They have cooking demos and speakers and booths and food tasting and lots of stuff for kids too, all right? So that is October 5th and 6th. You want to mark your calendar for that. And if you need information on any of these events, if you want more details, you can actually go to the Voices for the Animals Facebook page. Just search Voices for the Animals at Facebook.com to get more info on these events and other ones as well. So that sound you're listening to is the sound of wild horses in eastern Oregon being chased and rounded up by the U.S. Bureau of Land Management, the BLM, in what can only be described as a stampede of terror and panic. You can actually see some of those videos on YouTube if you want to look them up. Now, a little bit of history for you. These wild Mustangs are the ancestors of horses that have been part of the American West since before it was the American West. They've been on the continent for a long time. Others trace their lineage back to when horses were turned out to fend for themselves after farmers and ranchers and stagecoach drivers moved on to tractors and trucks. They were protected somewhat by a couple of different laws. There was a federal law in 1959 that protected them after public outcry, and then a historic law in 1971 called the Wild Free Roaming Horse and Burro Act. Now, I am sad to say that these poor horses have been a lightning rod of controversy ever since. And now the BLM, who oversees the management of these lands and the horses on it, and the wild burros as well that you sometimes see in Nevada, they are considering a controversial plan for permanently sterilizing the mares. And that brings us to our guest today, who I'm really excited to talk to. With us via phone is Brianna Schwartz. She is the Government Relations and Policy Counsel for the American Wild Horse Campaign. Brianna, thank you so much for being here to talk with us about this important issue. I have so many questions, but I'm going to start off with this one. Can you expand a little bit on the history I gave earlier about how these horses came to be here? I mean, are these Mustangs now considered indigenous to the land? And what's our responsibility to them?
Sure. So horses were here millions of years ago and were simply reintroduced by the European settlers. So the horse itself has ties to North America, and there's quite a few studies out there that confirm this. However, the BLM tends to cling to recent history of stock horses that the settlers let go wild. But honestly, either way you slice it, the American Mustang is a key part of American identity in our settling of the West and our nation's history. And even today, over 80% of Americans want to see them humanely managed and protected. And that's part of why the Wild and Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act was passed, was because of an outpouring of support by the American people to see these horses protected from the rustlers that were brutally rounding them up and killing them.
Right. You know, and honestly, given the amount of support that still remains for them, it's amazing that they're being managed the way they are. Can you talk a little bit about how the BLM is managing the horses these days?
Yeah, so every year the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, they round up thousands of wild horses and burros en masse from our public lands all throughout the West. They brutally stampede the horses by helicopter most times and separate families and ship them off to government holding facilities where they await adoption or sale, and they're never wild again. So this is all happening because the wild horses have to compete for their resources with commercial interests such as livestock, grazing, oil and gas, and mining, all within their federally designated habitats.
So let me ask you, why is the BLM being allowed to use helicopters when it seems that the laws specifically forbid their use in rounding up horses, right? Aren't they supposed to be free from harassment and use of transport and airplanes and so forth?
So in the Act, it does reference protecting the horses from capture, branding, harassment, or death, but the law doesn't explicitly say that the BLM can't use helicopters. So when the Wild Horse Act was passed, it was enacted at a time that Mustangers and ranchers and cowboys were taking it upon themselves to brutally round up the wild horses and burros and ship them off for pet food and glue and those sorts of brutal things. So that was more what that language was referencing.
At this point, I mean, let's talk numbers a little bit. How many horses are currently on public lands, estimated, obviously, and how many are being held in corrals throughout the country by the BLM?
So the BLM estimates that somewhere in the low 80,000 range are out on the range today, and that number is put together by estimating a 20% population increase per year. It's hard to tell exactly how many horses are out there. Many census documents are not done every single year in every single HMA, so of course it's an approximate number. Mm. But in holding, they also have about 51,000 wild horses and burros that are permanently living in government holding facilities. A lot of them don't have adequate shelter. There are internal standards that the BLM is supposed to abide by, but we've seen some cases where those aren't exactly being followed as far as humane management and feeding and cleanliness of the corrals themselves.
What I want to find out is how much is this costing the U.S. taxpayer at this point to round up and to care for these horses long term?
So quite a bit, actually. Looking at fiscal year 2019, the BLM spent 70% of its budget on holding wild horses in captivity. And so that breaks down to about $42 million taxpayer dollars.
So in this part of the country, we see lots of adoption events of wild horses, and I know they happen in states throughout the West, but I know also that the BLM was actually caught selling some of these horses to kill buyers for slaughter in the past, and that's not supposed to happen either. Is it still going on, to your knowledge?
So it did happen. Between 2009 and 2012, there was one specifically egregious incident that set precedent in the program. So Tom Davis, which is was a rancher and was purchasing horses through the agency, was later investigated by the Office of Inspector General, and he was purchasing the horses and selling them to slaughter. Once that was discovered and confirmed, the BLM put out an internal policy to limit the number of horses that people could buy to 4 horses. Funny enough, last year the BLM overturned this policy, different administrations, and now allow people to purchase up to 26 horses at a time. And the new policy only lasted for about 8 months, you know, but the public was just completely outraged. Finally flipped it back. This internal memorandum is a little bit of a gray area for the BLM. A purchaser or adopter has to sign a contract, so that's the sale with limitations idea, that they will not intent. They're not purchasing the horse with the intention of selling it for slaughter. They're not adopting the horse for that purpose. But the government doesn't follow through.
Right.
We find a lot of Mustangs across the country in kill lots.
Mm-hmm.
Before they cross at auctions and those sorts of things. We do have a rescue fund to our organization for that purpose, and we work with other organizations in order to save those Mustangs when they are found, if we can.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about long-term management, of course, because they're competing with commercial interests for the rangeland. The BLM is saying, you know, we really need to keep them from multiplying because they are going to starve. Nobody wants to see the horses starve on the range. So they have come up with this sterilization program. The sterilization program is in its experimental phases, from what I understand, and it's something called ovariectomy via colpotomy. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that right.
So essentially, it's a completely blind procedure. The surgeon feels around within the mare, makes small incisions before extracting each ovary, with what's called an accretor tool, which is essentially a rod-like tool with a chain loop on the end that's used to sever the ovary from the mare's body, for lack of a better way to say that, and extracts both ovaries, then lets the mare go. There's no sutures involved or anything like that.
So I understand that maybe this is done with sedation, but there's no pain management for the horse.
That's correct. So there is mild sedation. The mare still has to be able to stand upright in this slot, but she's awake the entire time. No epidural is given. They're monitored for roughly 24 hours as they wake up from that mild sedation. Then they're moved to a separate holding pen for about 7 days, but there's absolutely no real oversight to make sure that they're recovering correctly. And any complications are addressed other than removing them when they pass away.
Wow. Is it true that they have tried this method before and found that it was not successful?
The BLM, to my knowledge, has not tried the procedure before.
Mm-hmm.
They rely on a study from the Sheldon National Wildlife Refuge that was done in around 2008. They sterilized some mares there with the same procedure and immediately released them back onto the range, but there was absolutely no oversight, no notation of their care, pain levels, that sort of thing. But they're clinging to that study as evidence that they can use it here. The success rate is not 100%. Mares do die from this procedure. They died at Sheldon, and the veterinarian that did that study has also done it for private groups that were interested mm-hmm. in the procedure to learn more about it, and also had high complication rates and deaths in those situations as well.
So they are essentially giving these horses a hysterectomy without any sort of pain medication. Do equine veterinarians have anything to say about this procedure and its effect on horses, or where do they come down on this, to your knowledge?
So many in the veterinarian community that we reached out to talk about the procedure with were not well-versed in the procedure. It's rather archaic. It's rather obscure. Many don't really know how it's done. It's a very old procedure. Technology has moved on and helped us, when we have to do this procedure on domestic mares, do it in a safer way or a different method. So many of the veterinarians that we spoke to weren't even familiar with it and didn't feel comfortable commenting on it. Those that were familiar with it expressed possible complication rates being extremely high, especially in wild mares that cannot be restrained from movement after the surgery, when the risk of hemorrhage is extremely high. They expressed concerns that no epidurals were being given for pain management. They expressed concerns that there was no adequate monitoring or aftercare of the mares. These were veterinarians that understand wild horse behavior and mare anatomy, and they don't think that the BLM should move forward with this procedure.
As a matter of fact, I understand that both Oregon State University and Colorado State University Colleges of Veterinary Medicine were involved in the BLM in this project earlier on, but have now terminated their partnerships over it. Is that correct?
It is correct. OSU was partnered with the BLM in 2016 when the plan was a little different. They were planning to study three different types of sterilization, female sterilization. CSU partnered in 2018 when the BLM chose ovariectomy via colpotomy specifically. there weren't really clear reasons for either institution backing out of the plans, but I suspect that public pressure had a lot to do with it, because mm-hmm. the public really understands what this means to the mares and what they're going to go through, and they don't stand for it.
You're listening to Voices for the Animals. I'm this month's host, Michelle Coppola, and today we are speaking with Brianna Schwartz, Policy Counsel for the American Wild Horse Campaign, about the Bureau of Land Management's proposed and controversial sterilization program for wild horses in Oregon. If implemented, this inhumane procedure could be used on wild mares throughout the West. Do I have that correct, Brianna, that they're doing this in Oregon as a test and then may implement it elsewhere?
That's correct. They've expressed that their intention is to find a procedure that they can do on the range and use as a management tool across the West.
So I understand that there are indeed more humane options for sterilization. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Just up front, pretty much any other procedure is a little bit more humane than the one that's an extremely archaic procedure and it's done completely blind. There's a very high risk of complication, and the study that the BLM relies upon was done in 2008, and technology has advanced since then, and had advanced at that point even.
Right.
One option to make it safer would be to use a laparoscope so that the veterinarian can actually see what they're doing to decrease the risk of hemorrhage, but the BLM has ruled that out as cost prohibitive. There are several other surgical procedures that they proposed to study in 2016 that have lower risks, but we are more comfortable with much less invasive procedures, not even procedures, honestly. They're more vaccines mm-hmm. That can be given remotely and have effectiveness from 2 to 5 years. The one that is the most proven is called PZP. It's an immunocontraceptive vaccine, which is essentially birth control for horses.
Mm-hmm.
It can be given remotely. The horse never has to get handled. Or if the horse is already in a trap or in holding, it can be given by hand, whatever the situation may warrant. But mares carry to term. There's very low risks. Even in the dart itself, it just drops out. Very few experience any complications from that procedure. IUDs are also being investigated at this point. There's not a lot of science around those yet, but that could be a safer alternative than surgically removing a mare's ovaries.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other vaccines as well that are being developed and studied.
I mean, it would seem to me that even gelding the males would be more humane. Well, it's not really humane, but I mean, it would be easier than doing this very invasive procedure on the females. Is there a reason that's not considered at all?
But the BLM has considered gelding in a few HMAs, not in this particular case that we're discussing today, but our concern with gelding is the way that the BLM goes about doing it.
Mm.
It's, again, done in a very not sterile environment.
Right.
There's very little recovery time, very little pain management. We see this a lot because stallions are gelded before they're offered to the public for
right.
adoption. So if you go to a holding facility right after the males have been gelded, they have blood running down their legs.
Ugh.
And they're in obvious pain, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about that male then being released immediately onto the range, there are significant infection concerns, because while it is an external procedure, you still have a wound there that is healing.
And it's still painful.
Yeah, exactly.
It's still very, very painful.
It still alters their wild behaviors, which is one of our chief concerns. The PZP vaccine in mares does not alter their behaviors. It preserves them, and things like ovariectomy and gelding alter behaviors.
What is the BLM's main argument against using these much more humane methods that obviously would have much more public support? I mean, I know they're going to say it's financial, but I would imagine that with the money they're spending on boarding these horses for life, that, you know, if they were able to get the horses to stop reproducing in a humane way, that, you know, it would be a wash, right?
You would think. But the BLM spends 0% of its budget on humane fertility control every year, and it spends, as I mentioned, $42 million on holding alone, and that's without even factoring in the roundups, which is millions more. They refuse to implement fertility control, being PVP, in a way that will actually make a difference. And you can't say it doesn't work if you don't try to use it. The National Academy of Sciences has said this is their best option. Advocates are on board with this. The public is on board with this. But BLM is convinced that PVP is not a long-term option for humane management. And we can't seem to get through to them.
Are they just saying it's not logistically possible because it has to be redone every year or two and that it's just an expense issue? Is that just their only wall to it? Or does there seem to be some sort of...
Yeah, primarily.
Yeah.
Primarily, yes, because a lot of the herds are afraid of humans, right?
Right.
And so it is harder to go out there with a team like we have set up in Nevada that goes out and has darted, I think, about 700 mares on the Nevada range at this point.
Mm-hmm.
He mainly darted them with dart guns and has a whole program set up out there that the BLM could model off of. But that doesn't work for every HMA, depending on the horse behaviors there. They could set up bait traps and those sorts of things to bring the horses in. But they would rather round them up because they view that as easier and faster to get the numbers down. However, that leads to compensatory reproduction, which just means that the horses put the numbers back that the BLM just took off.
Wow.
And so they've created this emergency by continually rounding up and removing instead of implementing fertility control with their roundups. So we view it as a comprehensive plan that if they must continue roundups, they must also implement PVP fertility control so that we can together
right
to control the management and not just continue to perpetuate the problem.
Do we have a timeline of when this proposed sterilization study is taking place? Is it already happening? Can it potentially be stopped?
So, unfortunately, we don't have a timeline at this point. Originally, the BLM, in this last iteration, said that they wanted to begin in August. Obviously, we are well in August,
mm-hmm.
and they haven't released their final decision document yet. Once they do, if they do, release their final decision document, there's usually a 30-day appeal period where the agency cannot act on the decision. So if they release it tomorrow, we'd still be looking at 30 days from tomorrow.
Okay.
So at this point, we are just waiting for the agency to drop that decision.
Mm-hmm.
Once it does, we will evaluate the final decision and assess our legal options. AWHC and several other organizations have been watching this procedure as it's grown and developed in the agency, and we've challenged it twice before now, and we intend to challenge it again should the BLM provide a decision document that is full of holes, as the others have been.
Okay. So someone listening to this who really wants to be an advocate for the wild horses here in the West and in Oregon, what can they do? Where can they go to get the latest information to maybe voice their concern once the report comes out from the BLM? What actions can they take?
AmericanWildHorseCampaign.org is our website, and we have all of the information on there on how they can help. As wild horse and burro actions come up from the BLM, we put out action alerts and describe what the BLM is wanting to do, why it's harmful for horses, and what people can do to help. So if someone is interested in learning more about the issue or being alerted when this action or others come out from the BLM, they can sign up for our emails or follow us on Facebook and be alerted when those public comment periods are open so that they can voice their opinions and tell the BLM how they want their horses to be managed.
Wonderful. That is AmericanWildHorseCampaign.org. If you don't have a way to write that down right now, don't worry. We will have it on the Voices for the Animals Facebook page and also at the KBOO website at the Voices for the Animals page as well. Brianna, is there anything else that you would like people to know with regard to this issue that they should be aware of?
I just want them to know that these are your horses and burros on your public lands, and if you love horses or animals and you want to see them humanely protected, please use your voice and speak up for them. They can't speak for themselves.
Thank you, Brianna. What a wonderful way to end the show. Really appreciate your time today and for that statement, because that's really the bottom line, right? There are horses and we have a responsibility to them, and it's up to us to be their voice. Hopefully we can make some changes with the way they're managed. We do appreciate you being here as well. Thank you so much for listening. And if you want to know more about this issue, as Brianna mentioned, you can go to the wonderful and very informative website, AmericanWildHorseCampaign.org. You can follow what's happening with this issue right on that site. AmericanWildHorseCampaign.org will also have it at the Voices for the Animals Facebook page. And that will do it for this month's edition of Voices for the Animals. You can listen to a podcast of this program or wherever you download podcasts. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram, and we will talk to you again next month for Voices for the Animals. I'm Michelle Coppola.
The preceding program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio can be found online at kboo.fm.
You're tuned in to community-supported KBOO Community Radio. Coming up next is Got Science, but up first, this from KBOO.
What might an artist near the end of a well-lived life tell us about the creative process and the personal qualities or values they think are important for living a good life? Hi, I'm Bob Madar, inviting you to come on over to Local Folks Podcast for our last visit with Mickey, and listen to him talk about what he has learned after 96 years on the planet. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, list of programs, podcasts, web only, and click on Local Folks.
Hi, I'm Rick Mitchell, and I would like to invite you to check out my program Jazz in the New Millennium at kboo.fm. Each one-hour program focuses on a living jazz artist, putting their work in historical perspective from their earliest recordings to their most recent. The current season features such living masters as Jimmy Cobb, Keith Jarrett, and John McLaughlin, primetime players including Stephon Harris and James Carter, and rising stars such as Grace Kelly and Oren Evans. The weekly program is syndicated nationally by the African American Public Radio Consortium, but it can be heard anytime on KBOO's website by going to the drop-down menu at kboo.fm, clicking on audio, then podcasts, and scrolling down to the Jazz in the New Millennium page. New shows are generally posted weekly. That's Jazz in the New Millennium with Rick Mitchell at kboo.fm.
Thanks for tuning in to KBOO Community Supported Radio. If you've just tuned in, up next is Scott Science.
A tour of the exclusion zone around the former power plant costs around $100.
Officials say radiation levels are now low enough that visiting is safe, even though no one has been allowed to live here for decades.
It's not exactly picturesque, but the site of the world's worst nuclear accident is becoming a mainstream tourist attraction.
Welcome to the Got Science Podcast. I'm your host, Colleen MacDonald. Did you happen to catch Chernobyl, the miniseries, and wonder if something like that could happen here? Today we're talking about nuclear reactor safety. And stick around after the interview for This Week in Science History with Katie Love. Well, the HBO miniseries Chernobyl came into my life a few months ago and lit up my screen, along with the screens of 8 million other viewers, with the devastating aftermath of a nuclear power plant accident. While it was very dramatic and gripping, I couldn't help wonder how much of it was factual. As plenty of opinion pieces will tell you, the show improvised a lot on who was where and what happened when, but one of the things they did get right remains a problem to this day. When science is sidelined by other interests, political leaders don't make the decisions that are best for everybody. Our listeners know this scenario well because it's happening right now in the U.S. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which oversees commercial nuclear power plants and is tasked with protecting public health and safety, is very receptive to industry requests to cut the scope and frequency of many important safety inspections. We've seen the consequences of weak safety oversight before, from nuclear disasters like Chernobyl and Fukushima to the series of Boeing 737 MAX 8 crashes earlier this year. So why is the nuclear industry racing to roll back safety standards? In search of an answer, I welcomed my colleague, Dr. Edwin Lyman, back to the podcast. He's a physicist and acting director of the Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists. We spoke last year about proposals for a new generation of nuclear reactors. Today, he's back to talk about new threats to the safety of U.S. nuclear plants and explain why things have gone wrong in the past. We'll debunk some myths, answer questions from you, our listeners, and take a trip to a place most of us will never want to visit. Ed, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks for inviting me. Great to be here again.
So, Ed, did you watch the HBO miniseries Chernobyl?
I only managed to see 2 out of the 5 episodes, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I've heard a lot about it.
I'm sure you've read a lot about it. There's a lot of conversation going on. What did you take away from it?
Overall, the big picture historical events were accurate, but I feel like some of the details were hyped up for dramatic effect, and possibly the focus was shifted a little bit from where I think it needed to be. Overall, I'm certainly glad to see that it got people talking about nuclear safety, and I hope that the lessons of Chernobyl can be appreciated today, even in the different context here in the United States.
Is there an easy way for you to explain what happened?
The accident was initiated by a safety test. The safety test was going to be run in a regime where the reactor was unstable, but the reactor operators didn't really appreciate that. So when they started the test, they didn't fully understand the conditions in the reactor or the instabilities of the reactor, and as a result, they took actions which caused the reactor to be more unstable and eventually to experience a runaway chain reaction that is essentially overheat so rapidly that it caused a massive steam explosion, blew the a hole in the roof, and dispersed radioactivity over a wide area. A ensuing graphite fire burned for many days, continuing to release radioactivity until it was finally contained. So that's the accident in a nutshell.
Given the publicity of this miniseries, I was really surprised to see here, just in the news in the past couple of weeks, the nuclear industry pushing for less oversight of nuclear power plants. And I'm just curious, what's up with that?
Nuclear power plants in the country today are under great financial pressure, mostly due to the low cost of fossil fuels and their inability to compete. So the owners of the reactors are looking for any way possible to cut their operating costs. One expense that the operators see is due to the oversight of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The NRC conducts inspections that not only requires staff time at the reactors to prepare for those inspections, but it also could result in discovery of violations, which have to be fixed, and that means spending money. So if there are fewer inspections, if the inspections don't look as hard, they may miss problems, and the plant owners may have longer to address them because the regulators didn't catch them.
What are some examples of types of oversight that they want to ease up on?
One concrete example is a type of inspection that the NRC conducts every 2 years. And this is a special kind of inspection where the NRC is actually inspecting how reactor owners catch problems at their own plants. So it's a very important inspection because years ago, the NRC delegated more responsibility to plant owners for programs where they would look for problems and catch them and correct them on an ongoing basis. Because NRC inspectors can't look everywhere all the time. And so it's much better if the reactor owners are in a position to do their own reviews and inspections, but those have to be done properly. They have to be doing the right things. They have to be looking at the right frequency. And so as a result, to make sure that they're doing the right thing, the NRC has to watch them. But one of the proposals now is to reduce the NRC's oversight of those self-inspections. So if you allow reactor owners to have more responsibility for catching problems as they arise, you have to make sure that they're doing the right thing. So it's very important to make sure those inspections are of those programs are done at the right frequency. But the NRC has decided just to do them every 3 years instead of every two. And it's not clear that that's being based on any real issue that needs to be addressed. And that's really the problem with the changes that are being proposed now. It's not clear that they're actually solving any problems. There's no real rationale for doing them except to reduce oversight of the industry. And in that particular case, there were substantial objections from some NRC staff about reducing the frequency of these inspections without first assessing what the impacts could be. In other words, doing a comprehensive analysis of what those inspections do and how frequently do you really need to do them to make sure they're effective. That study has not been completed yet. Yet the staff is going ahead and recommending that they reduce the inspection frequency anyway.
Are there currently nuclear power plants that you are concerned about?
I'd say that every plant, you know, is unique and has its own concerns. Certainly, some make me worry more than others. For instance, the Indian Point nuclear plant in New York State. It's only 25 miles from the boundaries of New York City, where I grew up. That plant should not have been located where it is because the number of people within 50 miles, last time I checked, it was over 16 million, is really too great. If you're going to have nuclear power, you should make sure that there's a sufficient region around every plant that's low population density so that if evacuation or other emergency measures are needed, they can be carried out effectively. And by simply suburbanization and development, a lot of plants around the country that were originally sited in rural areas now find themselves in suburbs and populations increasing. And Indian Point's the poster child for that. It is shutting down in the next few years, but certainly the potential impact of Indian Point, both from a safety and a security perspective, has always been a concern. Then there are plants that are vulnerable to seismic events. They're vulnerable to flooding. And again, it's really highly dependent on the location of the plant and how it was designed in the first place. But I would say every plant has its own risks, and they have to be considered in their own context.
One of our listeners actually wrote in with a couple of questions. Let me run these by you. Given that our nuclear power plants are coming upwards of 40 years, what do current regulations say about when plants should be decommissioned?
Well, the current regulations allow for 40-year operating licenses for nuclear plants with the potential for a license renewal. Most plants have applied for and received 20-year license renewals, but that again, it's not an indication of the maximum lifetime of a plant. There is no regulation that specifies it. So some plants, I think there are six reactors now, have applied for what they call a subsequent license renewal. That would be from 60 years to 80 years.
Just keep changing that oil
right,
and, you know,
right.
Fixing the rust and it'll be fine.
A little facetious, but fundamentally the idea is the same. The idea is that it doesn't really matter too much how old the plant is, as long as you can inspect and maintain those system structures and components that are aging so that they stay within an acceptable range. Now, there are certain things that can't be changed. For instance, the concrete and steel containment buildings around most plants, it's not something that's going to be replaced. There's buried piping at a lot of plants. This piping was never intended to be replaced, but some of it is corroding. So there may be an issue with how do you manage those structures that can't be replaced. And finally, the reactor vessels. These are the steel vessels that hold the nuclear fuel in reactors. They become embrittled over time as they're bombarded with neutrons. And there is a risk that they could shatter like glass. if they are sufficiently embrittled and they undergo rapid cooling. So that's one of the, what it's called, a time-limiting aspects of nuclear plant, because those reactor vessels would be way too expensive to ever replace. So the NRC essentially says those components that can be monitored and maintained and replaced if necessary will be put under aging management programs. Those components that can't be replaced have to be assessed for how bad things will get by the end of the license period. So it's a long answer, but basically the NRC has no set lifetime for plants, but it is considering the first extended license renewal to 80 years.
We'll be back in a minute with the second half of our interview. The Got Science podcast is brought to you by the Union of Concerned Scientists. More at gotsciencepodcast.org. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, PRX, SoundCloud, and all the usual podcast outlets. If you'd like a transcript or links to additional resources from this episode and a full bio of our guest, head over to gotsciencepodcast.org. I'm continuing my push to promote Got Science, so please tell your friends, colleagues, family, your pet groomer about the episodes and topics you like. And if you have a sec, please leave us a review. It's quick and easy. When you open Got Science in your podcast app, scroll down to the bottom of the list to ratings and reviews and leave a comment. And finally, if you're on Twitter, come talk to us at GotScienceUCS. Now let's get back to our interview. So another question that came in was, he says, we've read that some U.S. nuclear missile defense systems are still running software off of floppy disks. How up to date is the automation and training at U.S. nuclear power facilities?
Well, here's the counterintuitive thing. Most nuclear plants have analog instrumentation control systems for the most critical safety-related components. That's because the plants are predate the digital era. And if you're going to upgrade those systems to digital, it introduces a wide range of issues that are hard to resolve. The most obvious is cybersecurity. So if you have a plant that is that has analog instrumentation controls, it's a lot harder for an offsite hacker to be able to affect those safety-related systems. However, if you upgrade to digital instrumentation control, then you are potentially opening up a new avenue for cyber attack. So you have to proceed with caution in upgrading those to digital instrumentation control. There's also an issue about really figuring out how those systems work in very complex scenarios, because nuclear plants have a lot of interrelated safety systems, and being able to disentangle those and have a clear path between how safety systems work and how the digital instrumentation controls would interact with them turns out to be a difficult task. So it may sound like an obvious thing that those plants should be upgraded to digital, but that does introduce complications that need to be fully assessed.
Ed, is it true that the next generation of nuclear power plants will be so safe that they can't melt down?
It is not true. Any nuclear plant has vulnerabilities that could result in a serious accident or could be exploited. It is true that you can design greater safety into nuclear power. There are ways to reduce that risk. But by and large, you're always going to have these vulnerabilities, and you can't depend on the design to save the day. It's always going to be good design plus a well-run plant, plus well-trained operators, plus robust inspections and maintenance, and also robust security to prevent against sabotage attacks.
How far-fetched is the idea that terrorists could attack a nuclear power plant? What would they be trying to do or to get?
For a commercial nuclear power plant in this country, the greatest concern is radiological sabotage. And that is a deliberate act that could destroy or disable enough of the safety systems and the backup safety systems that the reactor would melt down and there'd be very little that the plant operators could do about that. And it's a very real threat because if there were a well-trained paramilitary-type terrorist attack at a nuclear reactor without a robust security response, the attackers could essentially destroy enough equipment to cause a meltdown within minutes. So there's a very short time window for trying to respond if you have this type of event. The best thing to do is to prevent the attack from taking place. So in order to verify that, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission runs what it calls force-on-force inspections, where it actually leads a team, including a mock adversary force, to nuclear power plants. Every plant is tested every 3 years, and they run scenarios to test the security force of the plant, see if they can actually effectively defend the plant against these attackers. That's a program that's been required since after the 9/11 attacks. However, it's undergone a lot of changes over the last few years. The industry hates this type of exercise, especially if they lose. So they've been pressuring the NRC to make a lot of changes to the program that would make it harder for them to lose and give them fewer chances to lose. So there used to be three different scenarios run at each plant during these inspections. That's been reduced now to one.
If a disaster like Chernobyl happened here, how do you think that nuclear plant operators and the NRC would have dealt with it?
Well, to be clear, the U.S. does not have power plants of the Chernobyl-type design, the RBMK. So the particular sequence of events that led to Chernobyl is not really plausible at the light water reactors in the United States. However, there are other types of events that could result in similar consequences, and we saw that at Fukushima Daiichi, the accident in Japan in March 2011, where three nuclear reactors of a design very similar to designs that are deployed here in the United States experienced meltdowns and large releases of radioactivity. So it's a fallacy to think that Chernobyl was an event that was only due to Soviet incompetence and corruption, and that kind of thing couldn't happen here. Chernobyl couldn't happen here, but Fukushima could, or something worse than Fukushima. So that possibility has to be addressed and protected against. And after Fukushima, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission did put into place requirements for plant operators to be able to cope with an event like Fukushima and hopefully to intervene effectively before the worst case where the reactor actually melts down. But those plans require testing. They require vigilance. They require equipment that's well-maintained and will be available. And they require thinking through all the what-ifs. You can't expect that you're going to anticipate everything that's going to happen. You have to be able to respond to events as they occur. And that's really the challenge, is having assurance that you're going to be able to handle whatever comes.
Would you take a trip to Chernobyl now?
Not only would I, but I have.
Really?
I was there in 2006. It was the 20th anniversary of the accident. I was in Ukraine for commemorations of the accident that were being held in Kyiv. And there was an organized tour of Chernobyl, so I did go. That was more than 10 years ago, so the dose rate was somewhat higher than it is today. We were all equipped with our own dosimeters because we didn't trust the Ukrainian Radiation Protection Authority. And so I kept an eye on the dose rates. And knowing, you know, if you've ever turned on a dosimeter when you're at 30,000 feet in an aircraft, the dose rates are fairly alarming. And the dose rates generally in the Chernobyl exclusion zone were comparable to those you'd experience at 30,000 feet in an aircraft. So it's a little bit shocking to see those kinds of numbers when you're standing at sea level. I did see one of the funniest things, if you can say it's funny, was in the exclusion zone, we had stopped in a village within the exclusion zone, a ruined, abandoned village with buildings, missing windows and roofs and doors, and totally overgrown. And so we're kind of just wandering around there like a ghost town. And then someone walks by walking a dog. There are people living there.
That's fascinating. I know there's a whole big tourist industry around it and people.
Right, and I think maybe they need to give more attention to radiation protection for the visitors there. Like I said, when we went in, there was virtually nothing except we had to pass through whole body counters at the perimeter. But again, not sure I trusted those machines. I did do my own surveys when I got home. Didn't seem to find any contamination.
Well, Ed, thanks for taking time to sit down and chat with me about Chernobyl, the miniseries.
Thank you. It was great.
And now it's time for This Week in Science History with Katie Love.
This week in science history, we're going to August 27th, 2003, in Fairbanks, Alaska. For those who don't know their Alaska geography, Fairbanks is the second most populated city in Alaska and the largest in the interior of the state. It's far enough north that around this time of year it's getting about 18 hours of sunlight, but in the depths of winter that drops to about 7.5, and the temperature can drop as low as 60 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. In conditions like that, it's all the more important to keep the power on. But for years, the city faced cascading blackouts and other smaller failures on a regular basis. So Fairbanks turned to battery power as a solution. On August 27th, 2003, they connected to a 1,400-ton battery energy storage system that covered more than 10,000 square feet. At the time, it was the world's largest battery, set to provide up to 40 megawatts of power for 7 minutes. Giving the power operators in Fairbanks a chance to turn on the city's backup diesel generators and restore power to the community. These days, energy storage isn't just a matter of backup systems. It's a climate solution that we need to be investing in. Our current energy system is kind of like the system we had for distributing food before refrigeration. Most food used to have to be eaten right away, but refrigeration allowed us to store food until we were ready to use it. We're currently operating on a similar use-it-or-lose-it basis with our electricity grid. For the most part, utilities have to produce the amount of electricity that is needed every second of every day, with no way to store excess energy for later use. That's where energy storage comes in, helping ensure that energy that's produced, but not used in that immediate moment, can still be put to use to fulfill later demands. Like the battery system in Fairbanks, expanding our energy storage can help reduce power outages for critical infrastructure. But it can also help reduce consumers' bills and, when partnered with clean energy sources, reduce global warming emissions. Strategic deployment of energy storage can also replace fossil fuel generation that disproportionately affects the health of low-income communities and communities of color. So while the people of Fairbanks use their battery energy storage system to temporarily keep the lights on in the face of power failures, we need to push to improve the grid's energy storage capabilities to help power a clean energy future in the face of increasing climate change.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Got Science podcast. Got Science is made possible by the 130,000 members of UCS, and especially our Partners for the Earth, the 12,000 supporters who make monthly contributions to stand up for science. Learn more at ucsusa.org/partners. Special thanks to Dr. Edwin Lyman, This Week in Science History by Katie Love, editing by Omari Spears, additional editing and music by Brian Middleton, research and writing by Pamela Worth and Jiayu Liang. Our executive producer is Rich Hayes, and I'm your host, Colleen McDonald. Come find us on Twitter at GotScienceUCS. Thanks, and see you next time.
What might an artist near the end of a well-lived life tell us about the creative process and the personal qualities or values they think are important for living a good life? Hi, I'm Bob Madar, inviting you to come on over to Local Folks Podcast for our last visit with Mickey and listen to him talk about what he has learned after 96 years on the planet. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, list of programs, podcasts, web only, and click on Local Folks.
Hi, I'm Rick Mitchell, and I would like to invite you to check out my program Jazz in the New Millennium at kboo.fm. Each one-hour program focuses on a living jazz artist, putting their work in historical perspective from their earliest recordings to their most recent. The current season features such living masters as Jimmy Cobb, Keith Jarrett, and John McLaughlin, primetime players including Stephon Harris and James Carter, and rising stars such as Grace Kelly and Oren Evans. The weekly program is syndicated nationally by the African American Public Radio Consortium, but it can be heard anytime on KBOO's website by going to the drop-down menu at kboo.fm, clicking on Audio, then Podcasts, and scrolling down to the Jazz in the New Millennium page. New shows are generally posted weekly. That's Jazz in the New Millennium with Rick Mitchell at kboo.fm.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Around the world at kboo.fm. It's time for Jazz Lives.